Good to see everybody tonight. If you have a Bible with you, if you'll open to 2 Kings chapter 16, continuing our study in the book of Kings. Last week we were looking at various kings of the northern kingdom. We went through five different kings that were there, and as we pointed out last week, things in the northern kingdom are rapidly deteriorating. There's all this infighting going on. There's most of the kings are removed from office through assassination, and the new kings that come up don't last very long. And so we were looking at that. So we looked at five really pretty bad kings up in the northern kingdom, a couple decent kings down in the southern kingdom, and we're just working our way towards the conclusion of some of these things, especially when it comes to the northern kingdom. But in chapter 16, we're going to go back down into the southern kingdom. If you're not sure what we're talking about when we say the northern and the southern kingdom, Israel has been divided. They've been divided for many years. Back after the reign of Solomon, a man by the name of Jeroboam split off from Judah and Jerusalem and took the northern tribes with him, 10 of the northern tribes, and created their own kingdom to the north where they had their own type of worship. And it was kind of an offshoot of the system that God had put into place, but it was a corruption of that thing. They had these really shiny golden cows that they would worship in place of going down to Jerusalem. But it was supposed to be kind of the worship of the one true God, but it was a perverted form. It was a man-made form of religion. So now, the southern kingdom has, by and large, been staying true to the Lord through all their various kings. But we're going to see a turn for the worse now in the southern kingdom. We're here in 2 Kings chapter 16, and we'll start with the first four verses here. It says, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Remember, Pekah is the king of the northern kingdom. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he didn't do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Ahaz becomes one of the worst kings of the southern kingdom so far. I say one of the worst. Many call him the worst, and maybe he is the worst, but there's a king that's going to be coming up later on after him that seems worse, but it could be that he's the worst because he paves the way for the backsliding of Israel here. And obviously, he's not a good king, whereas the other kings before him were faulted because they allowed the high places to remain intact and didn't remove them. The high places didn't get removed or anything, but this guy is described as being bad. He doesn't do what's right in the eyes of the Lord. He doesn't, he's not just faulted for not following through. He is cited as being a bad guy to begin with, not a good king. And so he's going to set the stage for God's later correction that comes to Judah. He's described as walking in the ways of the kings of Israel, which is not a compliment at all. There hasn't been a decent, there's only been one guy that's been kind of close to decent in the northern kingdom, but by and large, they've all been pretty bad and all been described as being bad, and they've continued this pattern of apostasy away from the worship that God had intended for the Israelites. And so clearly, he's embracing the patterns of these ungodly kings to the north. And it says that, makes this quick statement here that, he made his son pass through the fire. Now, what's this all about? This is describing something that God warned the Israelites about before they came into that land, into the land of Canaan, about this practice of Molech worship. And that's what's being described here. Now, it's really hard to say. You do any research on this at all, and it's very difficult to tell whether or not Molech was an actual deity that was worshipped in the ancient world, or whether this is describing a specific practice of worship. Because in actuality, the archaeological record leaves us no indication of a specific god named Molech. There's practices that are associated with that, and the practice that they see that's associated with this word, with this name, is always human sacrifice. And so So some believe that this isn't necessarily talking about a specific god, but it's actually talking about a specific practice, that of human sacrifice, or even worse, infant sacrifice. There are those who maintain that he was a god. The earliest record that we have goes back to the 12th century AD. It's in the rabbinical writings, and it states that it was a specific deity. It gives a description of him, half man, half bull, and that... But that actually describes a lot of different gods, and especially in the Phoenician culture. But the description the rabbinical record gives is that it was they would make an iron image of him with outstretched arms, and they would build a fire underneath the outstretched arms. And in their practice of worship, they would lay an infant on those hot arms that had been heated up under this fire and sacrifice the child that way. And there are ancient records out of Carthage that give the same kind of indication of something like that, though not associated with a name of a deity called Molech. So it could very well be that this was the Hebrew way of describing this type of practice, because we find that associated with several different of the pagan gods around there. And in the archaeological digs around Carthage, they've found whole fields of the remains of infants. That so clearly there was this practice of infanticide, of infant sacrifice. And so, either way, whether this was I guess I'm probably giving you more details. Robbie's back here going, get on with it. But it's interesting to me. The point is that this guy has fallen so far. I mean, he's so far removed from God's ways. It's described as an abomination. He's taken up the abominable practices of human sacrifice, including his own son. He made his own son, it says, to pass through the fire. What a horrifying thing. Now, Leviticus 20 pronounces the death sentence on anybody who practices human sacrifice. So clearly he doesn't seem to care about God's laws or God's decrees concerning that. And what he's doing, and it even says there in the text, he's instituting the practices, the very practices that brought judgment on the region of Canaan to begin with. You know, sometimes the arguments will come up about, you know, the conquest of Canaan, the territory of Canaan, and the establishment of Israel, and the term of it being a racial war gets thrown around. But in reality, the biblical record gives us a very clear indication this had nothing to do with race. It had nothing to do with anybody's race or racial heritage. It had everything to do with the practices that were taking place there. It had everything to do with this type of thing, this type of human sacrifice and perversion and corruption. And that's the thing that God moved out of the land for the Israelites to come in and possess. And now Ahaz is bringing it all right back in. He's reestablishing it, what God has put away. So he's not a good guy. We're clearly getting a picture here that this is not going well for the southern kingdom now. Verse 5, then Retzin, the king of Syria. Retzin, wasn't that inserts? Anyway, Retzin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war, and they besieged Ahaz, but couldn't overcome him. At that time, Retzin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath, and the Edomites went to Elath to dwell there to this day. Now, if you remember, Pekah was one of the kings that we looked at last week, one of the kings of the northern kingdom. And it was around this time, all of this is taking place during what is called the Neo-Assyrian Empire. In other words, Assyria at this time is gaining power. And it's one of the best recorded empires that we have of the ancient realm at that time, of the ancient history at that time. And so they're gaining power. They're spreading out all over the Mesopotamian region. I mean, they're taking over everything. And Pekah, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, was resisting this. He didn't want, you know, to be a vassal state to these guys. He didn't want to follow suit with that. And so he kind of rebels against that. And we saw last week, he ends up losing a lot of territory in the northern kingdom. That's when all of a sudden the tribe of Reuben disappears, the tribe of Gad disappears, the tribe of Manasseh disappear off the face of the map, gone forever. They lose that to the Assyrian kingdom. So this right here, this attack on Judah, is part of his anti-Assyrian policy. He doesn't want to just roll over and allow this to happen. So what he does is he decides to form an alliance with Syria, and he goes down to attack Judah so that he can put a Syrian king on the throne, expand his territory, increase his power to better withstand an onslaught from the Assyrian Empire. confused? You should be, because all of these political machinations are very confusing. But basically, that's what's going on. This is a power play. They're trying to stop the northern kingdoms are trying to stop Assyria. According to 2 Chronicles 28, when they talk about this report, Judah starts off suffering a lot of losses. They suffer a real bad turn of events for themselves. They lose a lot of military technology. They lose a lot of soldiers. They lose some territory in along the way. But things turn around somewhere along the way, and the forces, this Confederate force of Syrian and Israeli forces, are not able to break through the major cities of Judah, including Jerusalem, which leaves Ahaz on the throne and thwarts their whole plan. They want to remove Ahaz from the throne so that they can, create this expanded empire of their own, and they're not able to do it. And what's really interesting to me, the real stuff that's interesting, is that Isaiah 7 gives us a kind of an account of this a little bit, and you don't need to turn there. But what happens in Isaiah 7 is Ahaz, the king, is walking around, and Isaiah the prophet meets him up on one of the aqueducts and confronts him. And he says to him, this is not going to work. The king of Syria and the king of Israel are not going to be able to take Jerusalem. It's not going to happen. God's not going to let them destroy this. You're going to be okay in this, in that your kingdom is going to remain. And then he says to Ahaz, ask the Lord for a sign to confirm what it is that I'm saying to you. And Ahaz, pretty much in disdain, says, I'm not going to bother with that. I'm not going to bother the Lord. I don't want no sign. And Isaiah kind of gets upset and even says to him, are you going to, treat the Lord like you treat everybody else? You're going to try to irritate him too? The Lord's going to give you a sign anyway. And so then he speaks this prophecy, and he said, here's the sign. Behold, a virgin will conceive and will bear a son, and his name will be Emmanuel, God with us. What a strange place for that prophecy to suddenly show up. Here he is, he's prophesying to this rebellious king who doesn't want rescuing from God, doesn't really care about God, doesn't care about some rescue plan that God's got in mind. He's got his own thing he's trying to work out. And yet God gives him a sign anyway. And what's curious about this is when you look at the immediate fulfillment of what this sign is that it's kind of a word picture. Isaiah is basically saying to Ahaz, as inconceivable as it would be for a virgin to get pregnant and bear a son, so your rescue is going to seem inconceivable. It's going to seem like it's not possible, and yet it's going to happen because I am with you. God is with us. I am with you, whether you believe it or not, whether you're going to receive it from me or not. And then when you think about the larger application, how this thing really gets fulfilled in its fullness. Remember, I believe that there are multiple fulfillments to prophecy. Here's a great example of that. It had an immediate fulfillment, and yet it had this long-range picture that it was showing of the real rescue, the rescue of a fallen world, not just a fallen king, but a fallen world. And whether they recognize it or not, whether the world wants to receive it or not, the rescue has come. God has been among us. God is with us through the person of Jesus Christ, now through the church. So it's an amazing picture, and you see how it gets fulfilled in multiple ways. This time, not just rescuing a rebellious king, but rescuing the whole world. So anyway, that's just a little aside. We pick back up in our story, verse 7. And Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, and he sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried its people captive to Kir and killed Rezin. Okay, this makes sense what Ahaz does here. He goes to the enemy of the king of, since obviously Pekah's complaint is Assyria, he goes to Pekah's enemy to become his friend, and thus, the enemy of my, what, the enemy, my, the, you know how that goes. You know what I'm, it's, yeah, exactly, what she said. And so, and that's the concept behind this. And so he, but it shows why Ahaz didn't want to seek a sign from God, because obviously he had his own solutions cooking already. He was going to go up and make an alliance with this new powerful empire and get on their good side. But he calls himself the servant and the son to Tiglath-Pileser. So in essence, what he's doing, though, is surrendering to one enemy in order to escape from another enemy. And we can only wonder what would have happened if he'd have heeded Isaiah, if he'd have listened to Isaiah and said those words to God. I am your servant and your son. Will you save me? Will you rescue me? But instead, he goes to a human king, and well, we'll see what the final results of that are later on. But in order to pay for his protection, he has to strip the temple and his own palace of everything that's shiny, all the gold and all the goodies and all that kind of stuff, and he's got to send it up to the Assyrian emperor. So, I mean, to me, it's probably the saddest epitaph for this man altogether, is that he turns to what seems to be a powerful king on this earth, to the ways of this world, and says, I'm your servant and your son, when God stood before him in the word of Isaiah the prophet, saying, ask me a sign, I'll take care of you. I'll work this out for you. I'll rescue you. And of course, God rescued him whether he wanted it or not for his own sake, for his own purposes. But what could have happened? What could have been? Verse 10, now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he saw an altar that was in Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah, the priest, to design the design of the altar and its pattern according to all of its workmanship. Then Uriah, the priest, built an altar according to all the King Ahaz had sent him from Damascus. So Uriah, the priest, made it before King Ahaz came back from Damascus. Okay, now this is not a normal thing for a king to make this kind of a trip in person. Normally a king sends emissaries if he's going to meet with somebody else. This clearly shows that this is part of his official surrender to his official subjection to the Assyrian emperor. He's going in person to present himself because he's part of the vassal. He's one of the vassals of the Assyrian empire now. And when he's there, it says that he spots this altar that really catches his fancy. It's really neat looking. And, you know, 2 Chronicles 28:23 explains why. By this time, Ahaz is so corrupted in his thinking that he believes that the gods of Assyria and the gods that were at work in taking Damascus were very powerful. And when he sees the altar that they set up there, he believes that those gods were the ones that delivered Damascus and delivered Syria to the Assyrian people. And so he decides that he's going to begin worshiping and serving them. Verse 23 in 2 Chronicles 28 ends up with the words, but they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. So he goes up there and he sees something he's really clever. You know, that whatever the altar was, it was really neat looking. It was, you know, it was, God had a lot of pizzazz and you know, it was cutting edge. It was the, you know, the latest thing, the newest thing to come around. Everybody was into it. I mean, everybody was doing it. It was cool. And so when he saw that, you know, immediately that's what, you know, he wanted to be able to have done in his place. And to me, you know, this is in so many ways a picture of some of the things that we, even as the church, end up doing. To me, when the church begins to lean heavily on marketing techniques and the methodology that we see that's employed within the business world, or, you know, the clever principles for success, all of these different things that seem to make the rounds on a regular basis. They never stay for any length of time, but they make the rounds regularly, especially through the American church. To me, I can't help but see it being similar to looking for the gods of Damascus to give a little help and boost our numbers or whatever it is that we're looking for. To me, I say, let God be God. Let the God who said he was going to rescue us do this. Let God become a reality in our lives as we live out our daily lives in desiring to follow him and serve him. And to me, I'm just not interested in snazzy Damascus altars. That kind of stuff has never been interesting to me, and techniques like that. And it's something that to keep in mind. This ends up being something that gets him really far off the path, and we certainly don't want to find ourselves in that kind of a situation. So Ahazi's up there. He sees this really cool altar. He snaps a few photos of it off of his cell phone. He emails them to the high priest. And that's what's really interesting, is that this is the high priest of the temple of God that he sends these plans to. And the high priest of God's temple gets these things, says, oh, that's just no problem. Downloads a few photos of them, gets a few contractors out there, and he gets the thing built before Ahaz can even catch another flight out of Damascus. As soon as he gets back home, here's this nice altar, and it looks just like the one up there. And it's the high priest of God's temple who's complicit in doing this. I mean, obviously, Ahaz is primarily to blame. He's the one going out searching for these other things, looking, you know, he's found no satisfaction in God. And so he's looking all over the place for lesser lovers. He's looking for something else to maybe satisfy and provide for him what it is he thinks that he needs that's not God. And so obviously he's to blame in all of this, but it's just amazing to me that Uriah, the high priest, goes right along with this without a complaint. At least during the days of Amatziah, when he decided he was going to go in burn incense on the altar. Remember the high priest and all the other priests, they formed a, you know, like a blockade. You're not going to get through here, no way. You know, they tried to stop him. They tried to turn him around. And in this situation, they didn't do a thing. Uriah gets these plans. It's all cool. That's a great idea. Yeah, let's go with this. And whatever you say, boss, it's just an amazing thing to me. But it also maybe is a picture of the danger that's involved in getting too close to the political machinations of anything. You know, there needs to be when God set up the Old Testament system of worship, he made it very clear that the king was never to be practicing the work of a priest. And there was a huge distinction in all of that. And I think there's a level of danger that's involved in this when the church tries to cozy up too much to the people in power and the position of power. Remember, when the church was without power, in other words, when the church was persecuted, when at the time of her conception and birth into the earth, when she was persecuted, she turned the world upside down. I mean, but at the moment she rose to power and gained that position of power, she's done some terrible things. Things that you know, we have to still give an answer for. Oh yeah, the Crusades, sorry about that. You know, crazy things like that. And so to me, there's warnings that you see peppered through here all the time about the politics of this world and the people of God and their place in that. All right, enough of my opinions on those things. Verse 12, then the king came back from Damascus, and the king saw the altar. Whoopee! And the king approached the altar and made offerings on it. And so he burned his burnt offering and grain offering, and he poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. He also brought the bronze altar, which was before the Lord, from the front of the temple, from between the new altar and the house of the Lord, and he put it on the north side of the new altar. Then King Ahaz commanded Uriah, the priest, saying, on the great new altar, burn the morning burnt offering and evening grain offering, the king's burnt offering and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offering and their drink offerings. And you kind of get the picture here. And blah, blah, blah. And the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. In other words, I'll take the bronze altar that used to be out there that the Lord had instituted, and I'll set this over here, and I'll just use that on special occasions if I needed a good luck charm somewhere along the way. Thus did Uriah, verse 16, the priest, according to all that that King Ahaz had commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the panels of the carts. Remember, around the temple there were those 12 carts that were kind of decorative, and they also had lavers in them for ceremonial washings and things like that. So he cut the panels off of that because they were gold-covered panels. And he removed the lavers from them, and he took down the sea from the bronze oxen. Remember, there was a big old bathtub sitting on a bunch of golden oxen out in front, and that also, we believe, was for ceremonial washing. And so, I don't know, he got a bunch of guys together and they lifted it off of those things and they set it somewhere else, somewhere off to the side, so that it was no longer in a position of prominence, but somewhere removed. And verse 18, he also removed the Sabbath pavilion, which they had built in the temple. And he removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaz, which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Ahaz rested with his fathers, and he was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place. Now, this whole section is just weird because the terminology is pointing towards the sacrificial practices of Judaism. I mean, everything that they're talking about in the grain offering, the burnt offering, the peace offering, all of this is using the language that God originally instituted in the worship practices of Israel. But Ahaz, it says, is doing this stuff on his own brand new altar. So, I mean, there's all kinds of problems with this all the way around. I mean, beyond just the idea that, you know, he's using this altar that, that the Lord didn't prescribe, but comes from a pagan influence, and is a pagan altar, he's doing it himself. And as we stated earlier, the king isn't supposed to be doing the priestly stuff. So in some ways, we look at this and we think that maybe this is a lot like Jeroboam. He's trying to keep some of the elements of Judaism in place while he introduces all this other stuff, gets a new altar, gets some new gods, sprinkles in some other stuff, and whatever. He has all the fun stuff that's involved in that kind of stuff. So it only makes sense then that he's doing this himself. As you look at this, Uriah is complicit, you know, with this whole thing. I mean, you know, every time that he needs something done, he goes to Uriah, the high priest. So the high priest, instead of standing up for the Lord, instead of fighting for the honor of the Lord in all of these things, he goes right along with whatever it is that, that Ahaz tells him to do in setting up this false religion. And, you know, that's the way it always is. When somebody's desiring to do something like this, somebody's desiring to set up something that is turning aside from the ways that God originally instituted. I mean, there's always going to be somebody out there who's willing to go along with it, who's willing to compromise and get involved in something like that. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of personal benefit to Uriah to do this. And when we finally get around to the prophets, the writings of Isaiah, especially and Micah, who were prophesying during this time, that's one of the complaints that they're going to be making all the time, is how the corruption was there among the priests. You know, the priests didn't stand up for the Lord, but they actually went along with all of these things, and they fell for all this stuff. And so we see that this is how this is going on. Now, it's interesting, too, that we notice that he removed the king's outer entrance to the temple. It says he did this because of the king of Assyria. In other words, now that he's a vassal state, there are going to be representatives from the Assyrian government there moving freely through the palace and observing everything that goes on. So there must be something about that, either because he felt felt the pressure of that from the Assyrian people, that he was going to remove his connection from the temple, or whatever it was that's involved in that. What that had to do with Assyria isn't totally clear, but what is clear is that he removes his connection to the temple. He takes that step much farther away from the Lord. He doesn't want that close connection anymore between the ways that God had ordained and the way that he wants to go now. And so he didn't need that old door anymore, and he removes it. There's an interesting pattern that we see through this whole last section, all these verses that make up the last part of this chapter. And it's this interesting progression where we see this de-emphasis that Ahaz begins as he's introducing this new religion. And it's really interesting if you look at that. When he came back from Damascus with this new idea of this new religion that is going to infuse these new ways and this new God and this new altar, he didn't just come in like gangbusters. He didn't just come in saying, well, away with the old and bring on the new, we're going to do something else. Because he knows right off the bat that would have caused alarm. I mean, the people would have rebelled against that. Everybody would have been saying, wait a minute, you can't do that. But instead what he does is start enhancing what's there. He starts adding to everything that's already in place. Well, listen, we got this really cool altar, cutting edge. It's, you know, European. And we're going to bring this in here, and it's really nice, and we're going to set this up here, and we'll just move the other one over here. And then all of a sudden, you see this subtle, but really not so subtle, de-emphasis of the things that God had ordained. He begins pulling the panels off of things. Well, why are you pulling those panels off? Well, we're going to do something even better over here, away from these old carts with their little water and their ladles and all that. We're going to do something else, something better. It doesn't actually say what he did with those, but obviously it was to to create some other form or to probably use the gold off of it for something else. But the idea is these renovations are designed to de-emphasize the former aspects that God had set up in terms of the worship in the temple in exchange for these new practices that Ahaz is introducing to them. And it's a brilliant strategy when you think of it. He wasn't going to get the people in an uproar. He wasn't going to get them riled up. Little by little, in these subtle ways, things are beginning to change right before their eyes. And there's a move. There's a departure from what had been established. You know, that's just such a picture. I mean, it's an amazing picture in a lot of ways, and an amazingly accurate picture of what our enemy does in our lives on a daily basis. I mean, really, this is the struggle that we face in our lives. We, remember, are the temple. There's no more temple of brick and stone and wood anymore. Now the temple is our lives, and the temple is the church as it's brought together, the people of God as we're assembled together. This is what our enemy is at work trying to do on a regular basis, to begin this process of de-emphasizing the things that God put in there. You know, a lot of that stuff is kind of hard anyway. But let's think about these other things that are, well, they're present in our culture. And I mean, it's the rage. It's the way everybody thinks nowadays. It's the way we see the world nowadays. It's better. It's new. It's so much more accommodating to us as human beings. And we lose sight, little by little, of the reality of what God had established to begin with. And little by little, in subtle ways, without alarming us to get our attention, but in subtle ways, because we're faced with an onslaught of this de-emphasis of God's ways from the moment we wake up in the morning, from the first time we turn on the TV till we lay down at bed at night, this onslaught of this de-emphasis of God's ways and this introduction of a different point of view. Has God really said you can't eat all of the fruit in this garden? That's crazy talk. Clearly you didn't understand. Clearly there's some other way that you can go. All day long we're faced with that. And so that's why it's important for us as his followers to not allow this to happen. How do we not allow this to happen? How we prevent this from happening is, for one, staying with what God's revealed. So that's why, to me, you know, When I see some of the patterns that develop in the church, and listen, I'm all for experiential Christianity. I am all for it. I am all for us not just getting a head full of facts and knowledge, but I am all for us being able to embrace the truths of God on multiple sensory levels. I'm all for that. And I'm all for being able to reach out into our culture and hearing God from different places besides just the Bible. I am all for that because I believe God is big. And just like in Acts 17, we see he's able to speak through a lot of things. But I am not for any of that to the neglect of the study of the Word of God. The only way we're ever going to know the life we were meant to live is by getting into this, coming back to this. You know, and I know some use the terminology of stand in the crossroads and look for the old paths and walk in them. And they use that to try to decry anything that seems emergent or anything like that. And I'm not meaning it that way, but there is something in that. God did say that through his prophet Jeremiah. There is something to that. We want to stand at the crossroads. In other words, when we face a decision in life, when we're faced with choices that we have to make as believers, as followers of Jesus Christ, we've got to stand at that crossroads and look for the old paths. Look for the ancient words that have come to us that declare to us the life we were meant to live. There's a life we were meant to live, and there's another life that's presented to us daily. A de-emphasis on God's ways and his purposes that's constantly barraging us and attacking us. We have to come back to this, come back to his word. That's why we take the time that we take to study it. We're going to go through it book by book, chapter by chapter, however long it takes me. If I live long enough to make it, I'll be here doing it. But I want to go through this. I want to teach it. I want to explore it together. I want to learn what it says so we can find out what his will is for our lives, to find out the people that we were meant to be from the very beginning and leave off of this substitute life that was presented to us that we lived for far too many years in the lives that we lived outside of him. So that's it. That's what we'll finish with and we'll pick up next time. So Father, we thank you for your word, and we thank you, Lord, that we can come to this and that we've got the freedom that we got to be able to gather together like this, to explore so freely what you've provided. I just pray, Lord, we never take that for granted, that we don't pass up these opportunities, that we open our ears and our eyes and our hearts to glean everything we can from your word so that we can follow you and be who we were meant to be. I just pray this for us, Father, in Jesus' name, amen.